I run an outfit called Ghost Troop, like Casper the Friendly Ghost Troop. And we're made up of veterans and military and police professionals, both active and former status, who look into the media cycle, much the way I'm sure you do, and we can infer a lot of things from the media. Now, a lot of that goes back to my specialty in intelligence, especially Russian area intelligence, from the days when I used to, for the U.S. Army, pick up newspapers that were written in communist countries, and you knew that every word on the front page was a lie, but if you knew how to read carefully, you could pick out the truth between the lies. So just for a nickel's worth of demonstration, «Я могу говорить с тобой по-русски, если ты хочешь», that's Russian, and a few other languages. So I was an MI fellow.
Okay.
Now, I came off active duty, and my last assignment was with the 75th Division in Houston, Texas, where I was on the general staff as a public affairs officer, and had spent the previous 5 years as an opposing forces specialist, meaning I pretended to be the enemy all the time. That was my job. I came off active duty about 95, 96, and then started writing for the mainstream media. I did writing with NBC Editorials, Houston affiliate. I did a few spot pieces for the Wall Street Journal editorials, and wrote for the Houston Chronicle, a little bit of military analysis, among other things. As this war started coming up, meaning the Iraq War, I started writing analysis for the Chronicle, and I stuck by earlier predictions I'd made going way back to the year after Desert Storm, where I agreed with Papa Bush and said that it was a quicksand war if we got into it, that getting pulled into the Middle East would be something we couldn't get out of and probably couldn't win. Now, that got me in hot water pretty quickly, writing here in the Bush southern capital of Houston, Texas,
right.
And pretty quickly I was blackballed from writing in the mainstream media. I was following the war early on, as we, your listeners will remember, we marched across the desert up north in the Euphrates Valley, and U.S. forces reached Baghdad April of 2003. Now, what's going to happen next is that your listeners are going to remember a cute little blonde girl named Jessica Lynch, who the story was she'd been captured, she fought heroically. You know, special forces had gone in and rescued her from the arms of the Iraqi captors. Well, all that turned out to be kind of hoaxed up. She'd really gotten lost with her convoy, gotten ambushed, got wounded, and the Iraqis thought they had a pretty good, valuable prisoner there, so they took pretty good care of her, it seems, and actually tried to hand her over to American forces. The whole Jessica Lynch story was a Hollywood story. But the reason for the Jessica Lynch story was that, your listeners may also remember, something happened at Baghdad Airport on the night of April 5th, 2003. Now, with my background in intelligence and a pretty deep background in military tactics, it was apparent to me that the Battle of Baghdad City began that night at the Baghdad Airport. But for the next 4 days, all the American people saw was Jessica Lynch.
Now,
and then on the April 9th, they saw a statue falling down. The media programmed the people to understand Baghdad had fallen. They showed a statue of Saddam Hussein falling.
Captain, I remember that, and I remember the Jessica Lynch story, and I remember when Baghdad Bob, the foreign minister, no, the press secretary for the Iraqi government, was denying that there were troops in Baghdad, and, you know, clearly there were firefights going on at the airport, but something else happened at the Baghdad airport. Something really big that no mainstream media talked about, and that nobody in the military was willing to confirm until recently. Why don't you tell folks what it was that really happened, what was detonated at the Baghdad airport, and why this was covered up?
Sure. Well, the broad picture is that there was a four-day fight for the city of Baghdad beginning at the Baghdad airport. And that's what got covered up by Jessica Lynch. But to get to the particular night of the Baghdad airport, there's something called A Secret History of the Iraq War. Your folks can find it if they look in the bookstores, where there's very little told about the Baghdad airport battle, except that it was a six-hour fight that reached close quarters. Now, I picked up from a different international context, on contacts of mine, that it was to the point that there were actually war atrocities being carried out on captured American soldiers on film. It got in close. There were captured people. There were hundreds of dead boys. And what happened is after 6 hours of a firefight in which U.S. ground forces, that being the 3rd Infantry Division, particularly the 37th Cavalry Squadron, the 101st Airborne, and possibly some Marine forces, they'd expended all their ammo after 6 hours. The Iraqis had at least five battalions of Republican Guard and Fedayeen Saddam, or their volunteer forces.
Right.
And at the end of it all, with the U.S. forces running low on ammo, somebody from somewhere gave authorization to use a neutron warhead over the Baghdad airport. Now, I've got this multi-source through Army people who were there, Marine people who were there, and Arab journalists who were there or talked to people who were there. The important thing is that the American boys didn't know what had happened. They were never, the details were never filled in. But what happened was the American forces went and buttoned up inside their armored vehicle. Armored vehicles have pretty good protection against radioactive transmission.
Right.
They have a good transmission factor, it's called in professional terms.
Right.
And since they were inside and buttoned up, the Iraqis were outside and exposed. And the way I got it from the Iraqi side through Arab journalists was they thought they were doing real good until all of a sudden they started melting. So at that point, a nuke went off over Baghdad airport, maybe a series of nukes. And we think neutron is enhanced radiation, as I'm sure you know, Mr. Turner.
Yes, I am aware of that. But it wasn't a nuclear, it wasn't a fission device. It wasn't the Big Bang. It was a neutron warhead.
Right. And you know, the old Russians had a real good propaganda line about that. The neutron warhead has high toxicity because it has radioactive emission, but it has low burst. So right. The Russians used to make a joke about it in the 80s when we were trying to introduce it into the European arsenal by saying it was the perfect capitalist weapon because it killed people and saved property.
Right.
So that's a pretty good line. We found out since through various reports by medical authorities that there's an extremely high level of mutation and cancer around the Baghdad airport, along with things like livestock die-off and chicken die-off. Everything you could imagine. I picked up from American GIs going way back to 2004 that they were bringing in dump truck load of dirt in and taking just as much dirt out. So even back before I got the story, which you may have had or heard earlier than I did, that there was a neutron warhead used, I started getting hints of it. So I want to stress, the same way you do your intelligence analysis before you say something to your listeners, I did the same thing. I didn't say that a neutron had gone off at Baghdad the first time I heard that story.
Right.
I heard that story a dozen times, and it wasn't until I started getting independent factors that actually played into my analysis that I came to accept that. Since then, I've heard it from a lot of American VIPs, up to the Green Party candidate for president. You know, I deal with all kinds of people.
Right.
The Green Party presidential candidate, David Cobb, was an old college buddy of mine. And he told me that.
So,
like, I've gotten it from all over. So it sounds like that confirms what you got as well.
Now, let me jump in here for a sec to recap this briefly. Basically, what you're saying is that the military planners and or the White House botched Iraq War II. They botched
right.
it in the planning. They sent our troops in without enough firepower. And when the firepower was running out, they resorted to a weapon of mass destruction, which, to my knowledge, has never been deployed in anger previously.
Right, not that particular one.
They let loose with these neutron artillery shells. Were they artillery shells?
Well, now that I don't know. I don't know if it was a STRATCOM-ordered aerial delivery. I don't know if it was a missile, an ICBM, or a Tomahawk.
So
I don't know what the delivery means was.
So they let loose with this weapon of mass destruction, and then did the whole Jessica Lynch thing to divert the media and the public's attention away from the fact that we had used a neutron weapon in Baghdad.
Right. In every particular, the invasion plan was deficient. You know, I wasn't the only military guy who thought that it was going to be botched from the get-go. I was just one of the ones who was not on active duty anymore who could open my mouth and write about it.
Okay.
There are all kinds of people having doubts. But the one thing the Bush League, and that's our little term for the Bush people and his Zionist buddies, the one thing the Bush League knew that they had under control was they figured they could BS the public. They always knew they could lie to the public because all the media lined up behind the war. So when things started getting tough, what they decided was, what the hell, we'll just classify it all as a top secret and refuse to tell the public. We'll cover it all up. So you could say that from the very moment, now think about the ironies. We went there because we said we were trying to keep those rascals from getting WMDs.
Right.
And what's the first thing we do when the going gets tough?
Use one.
WMD. You see, it was a PR nightmare.
Okay.
Now, my view at that point, and of course, military doctrine and law, according to the Defense Department's Principles of Information, states that propaganda will not be used against the American people. You know, every time that military planners or military commanders, or the commander-in-chief in this case, screw up, they always try to cover up their mistakes by saying they're too secret to talk about.
Right.
But there's a whole body of regulation, which I had to learn as a trained public affairs officer, which says that's exactly what you're not supposed to do. You don't stab your people in the back when the going gets tough, because when you do that, you wind up compromising the nature of the American system. We depend on an informed populace.
Well, it turns out that the United States seems to have used a neutron weapon, or more than one neutron weapon. It was done at Baghdad Airport early in the attack upon Baghdad. And talking about this with me is Captain May, former U.S. Army intelligence officer. So, they covered up the use of these weapons, and they got rid of all the Iraqis who melted. Now, I remember seeing photographs of melted people. I remember seeing photographs of men whose legs had melted into or vaporized. There weren't even burn marks. Their feet, their calves, their knees were gone, and they were just stumps where their thighs were, but they were still standing where they died. They were just slumped in a ball. Could that be the effect of a neutron weapon?
Yeah, well, what you were saying was stuff that sounds like it came out of Nagasaki or Hiroshima. That's exactly the effect of a nuclear weapon. There were attempts to pass that off with disinformation, which is a big part of this current Bush League effort, as being a fast cam or fast scattering munitions, meaning little mini cluster bombs, or as being a Willy Peter or white phosphorus.
Fast cluster bombs would leave a bloody mess. There was no blood.
Right. So what you had was exactly the kind of stuff that if you think about the kind of effects you had at Nagasaki, where you're dealing with, you may be shielded from the heat by a piece of armor or something in one place, but have exposed skin in another place where part of your body stays normal and part of it gets a million degrees. You know, you're talking about temperatures like the surface of the sun with a neutron warhead. So that's what went on that night, and why it is that, the whole Baghdad Bob thing was really kind of – Baghdad Bob was about half lying, and U.S. public affairs was about half lying. But after Baghdad Airport, there was a massive effort to make it so that everything Baghdad Bob said was taken as being just the fact that Baghdad Bob said it meant that it was a lie. Well, that was a propaganda effort. That was a psychological operation,
right,
again, turned against the American people, which, again, is an illegal thing for the military to do.
So,
and the whole Battle of Baghdad that followed, even after Baghdad Airport, they didn't hand it over to us. There was days of fighting. And in those days of fighting, there were substantial casualties, horrible casualties on all sides. So the American people were getting this Zionist garbage through the media, which said that we'd walked into Baghdad and they'd just kind of run around. They'd run.
Right.
But in the Middle East, now, and of course you might say, well, the American people didn't need to know. But I don't think you or I would say that. But on the other hand, in the Middle East, all over the Middle East, they knew that we'd turned Baghdad into a Guernica, that we'd gone in and torn it up. We shot the place up.
Right.
And so as a result, we find ourselves operating within a kind of a Zionist envelope of lies, where the American people consistently have been told that, SHIT was really Shinola. But in the Middle East, they knew differently. So now the American people are amazed at why it is that worldwide we've become a pariah. And the reason is, do you know what they call our soldiers in Iraq, sir?
No.
They call them Jews. In other words, these guys we're fighting, and you know how much the Muslims and Jews hate each other. That's what this whole war is about, that and oil.
Right.
They call American soldiers Jews. And that means they hate us as much as they can possibly hate us, because they see us as nothing but attack dogs for Zionism.
Which is exactly how I see the present war, the present operation.
That makes two of us on the line.
I'll tell you, a lot of American people, for some bizarre reason, seem to think that Iraq had something to do with September 11th, and they never had anything to do with September 11th.
More propaganda.
Now, you were not in the military on September 11th, and you, like the rest of us, saw what unfolded that day. I don't know if there's anything more you wanted to say about Baghdad Airport or that. And
No. Let's go ahead and move on to September 11th. That's an important day for everyone.
Because, you know, here is another situation where the country has literally been propagandized in almost every facet of 911. Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. Well, first off, you know, a lot of people think, well, you're military intelligence, you pick it all up. But that's not true. When 9/11 happened, you know, I'm not an expert in structural engineering or anything else relating to the physical characteristics of 9/11. I bought it. Shucks, a year later, I volunteered to my best friend and best man, Ambassador Chase Untermyer, now in charge of Qatar, to return to military active service. I was declared ineligible and couldn't go. So I was really buying the whole propaganda line that this was 19 crazy Arab guys who were representing a worldwide evil movement that was intent on destroying America because it's the home of the brave. And that was the propaganda line.
Yes, it was.
And I spent an entire year on the Battle of Baghdad cover-up, which we call Bob Cup for Battle of Baghdad cover-up, for a very simple reason, which is that after Bush covered up that battle, he started letting loose his PSYOPs thugs on the orphans and widows out at Fort Stewart, Georgia, where the 3rd Infantry Division was from. So not only did we do all kinds of things we weren't supposed to do in the Battle of Baghdad because of this thug president we have, but he turned his goons loose to shut up the women and children of these heroes who had died in battle. He robbed them and desecrated them of their honor, which is a great shame to the military always, and he took it out on their kids. So at that point, I came out on a mission of conscience under death threat. I'd been told by Colonel Neil Dennington at the Marne Chapel, Fort Stewart, Georgia, on May 14, 2003, that the government was covering up the Constitution, that special forces units were going to enforce discipline, and assassination would be used to carry out discipline. I came out and spent a year on a mission of conscience, strictly on the Battle of Baghdad cover-up, all the while still believing the 911 story.
Okay.
Then after I'd published a site on the Battle of Baghdad cover-up, you know, as so much happens on the Internet now, an Internet operative named Captain Jeff Cross, a former Marine officer, got in touch with me. He had been in New York City on the day of 911. He'd been transitioning out of the Marine Corps into civilian life, one of those boots to business suits type program.
Yes.
Well, here's the competent officer who was on the scene, and he talked to me, and he must have talked to me for, four or five different times before he convinced me, because he had been there, that the whole thing was what's called a false flag operation, meaning the people who did it pretend to be someone else, or there's a story pretending that someone did it different from the people who actually did it.
Okay.
And his explanation was it was all CIA massage, it was a setup operation all the way around.
Now, this fits with facts that I have reported on this radio show since the attacks of September 11th. The two aircraft that took off out of Boston's Logan Airport, which ultimately crashed into the two towers at World Trade Center in New York, the security company that was responsible for airport security at Boston's Logan Airport was an Israeli security firm, and the men who staffed that security firm were all or mostly ex-Israeli military. And the idea that these 19 hijackers could have ever even gotten on those planes was ridiculous, but then plane number one takes off. A few minutes after takeoff, it deviates from its flight plan, and nobody can communicate with the plane. Well, in this country, as you know, since the 1970s, the standard operating procedure is the airport calls the FAA, the FAA calls NORAD, NORAD scrambles a fighter jet to find out what's wrong with the plane.
Sure, ricky-ticky, like real fast.
Right. This was not done for the first aircraft. The first aircraft is on its way now south from Boston toward New York. When the second aircraft takes off, 15 or 20 minutes into that flight, it too deviates from its flight plan and loses communication. And again, no military fighter jet was scrambled anywhere around Boston or anywhere in Connecticut or anywhere in New York State or anywhere in New Jersey. Plane number one hits the North Tower of the World Trade Center at about 8:43 or 8:46 a.m. Plane number two is still inbound. We have in New Jersey maybe 60 miles from my house, McGuire Air Force Base, at which fighter jets are stationed. We also have the Atlantic City Naval Air Station. Up north of us, we have Fort Stewart in New York State, which has fighter jets. Despite the fact that the first plane they lost contact with had struck the World Trade Center, and the second plane was also off course and out of communication, no fighter jets were scrambled to even intercept the second aircraft, which, as we know, struck the second tower. So right there, that told me that our government was complicit in these attacks. Maybe they didn't carry them out, but they knew it was going to happen, and they let it happen on purpose. And then I subsequently found out that they were actually in on it and probably made the plan themselves. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Yes, sir. Well, then you've gone through the same discovery process I did. It. You go from believing the story to seeing doubts to thinking, well, maybe they let it happen on purpose. That's the lie-hop argument, let it happen on purpose.
Right.
And eventually we all wind up in the my-hop argument, made it happen on purpose.
Ah.
I just published an article in the Lone Star Iconic class about that very argument, which is starting to become dominant in the 911 research community. There are so many ways of figuring the evidence. Now, you've probably heard that there were ongoing federal aviation drills simulating terrorist strikes on skyscrapers with airplanes that day.
Yes,
that was going on in real time. Cheney was running it.
Okay.
When you hear Cheney was in the bunker, they were doing, you know, the bunker drills they did June 19th this year?
Right.
A couple of weeks ago.
Right.
That's the exact same drill that was going on. It's a once-a-year drill that was going on the day of 9/11. In other words, the federal government was insulating itself against any possible coup d'etat by loyal officers.
Right.
The federal government was running exercises simulating exactly what they did, which is what that allowed them to control everybody and tell them to stand down.
Uh-huh.
And the federal government was coordinating at every level what happened to New York. You know, it's a funny thing. If I go out and burn down my own gas station, the first thing an insurance guy is going to do is question hard what happened and see if arson was the cause.
That's correct.
But the biggest arson in U.S. history happened on 9/11, and the day after it happened, they start hauling away the junk to get it out of the country. They destroy the crime scene instantaneously.
Yes.
And then do appoint a commission. The first person they try to put in charge of the commission is Henry Kissinger, Beelzebub himself, a British Yiddish hit all the way.
The government not only knew it was happening and let it happen on purpose, but quite probably and perhaps factually made it happen on purpose. Captain May, thanks for hanging on.
Thank you kindly for letting me stay over, Mr. Turner.
So, let's continue our discussion about what happened on September 11th, and we'll move from there. When the guys that you were talking to, that former Marine officer that was going from, you know, boots to business, when he started talking to you about what he saw, and you started listening and verifying some facts on your own, what conclusions did you draw that led you to made it happen on purpose?
Well, that's pretty easy. In fact, it'll resonate with what's going on now. But let me make it clear. When Captain Cross, and I'm pleased to use his name, he's my brother officer, and he was my executive officer as part of Ghost Troop after we became introduced. After Captain Jeff Cross, USNC, started talking to me, the first thing I did was close my eyes and shake my head and say, this can't be so. You know, at first, my mind reeled. You know, I was able to pick up Baghdad in a hurry because that was basically a tactical problem.
Right.
You know, I could see the logic of that because I'd done enough war game scenarios and seen enough military affairs. But with 9/11, it didn't ring until Madrid. When Madrid happened on 3/11, March 11th, 2004, everything about that operation reeked. And they started immediately trying to say it was al-Qaeda. As a matter of fact, they said it was the same al-Qaeda faction that for a while they've been trying to pin the East Coast blackout of August 2003 on. You remember that East Coast blackout?
I remember 14, 15, 50 hours we were without electricity here, and it was very hot.
Well, that one was easy for me because I picked that up at the time for what it was, a classified operation. That was another federal false flag attack. That was a federal knockdown of the power grid. It was a way of Bush flexing his muscles in the summer of 2003 when everybody knew knew that he'd gotten us into quicksand after promising us an easy war. So when they started blaming the Madrid bombing on the same group that did the East Coast blackout, and I knew the East Coast blackout was bogus at the time it happened, that just happened to be one of the things that was easy for me to understand. All of a sudden, it started clicking real fast. And then immediately after the Madrid bombing, they started saying, black cloud of death attack coming. And that was what they were saying was going to happen. And that played into my strength because back when I believed the Al-Qaeda story, I had written an editorial for the Houston Chronicle, a military analysis, which specifically predicted an Al-Qaeda attack on the Houston Petrochemical District. Because being former chemical, biological, and nuclear warfare expert myself, and knowing the political realities of the Houston area, I thought that Houston was the best target on the board for Al-Qaeda. Now, at this point of Madrid, I realized, my God, Captain Cross is telling me the truth. My God, these sons of guns set up Madrid, and they're the same ones who set up the East Coast blackout, and that must mean they're the ones who set up 9/11. And my God, everything I thought pointed at the Houston attack was nothing but federal misinformation fed to people to make them think Houston was going to be the attack. So I started, this was the time at which I put out my first alert because we had real strong indicators. They were even saying that Al-Qaeda had gotten a suitcase nuke.
I remember
that. They've been setting up the Islam bomb forever. So I realized George Bush is going to do it to his own house. The idea is once you figure out somebody's an arsonist, the first place for you to look for them to burn down a house is their own house.
Okay.
That's the easiest house to burn down. So we started worrying about Houston. We came up with a hard and fast prediction of March 31st, 2004, for a Houston petrochemical nuclear attack. Well, not coincidentally, March 30th, one day off, Texas City British Petroleum blew up for the first time in accordance with our prediction.
I remember
that. We missed it by 24 hours and 24 miles.
I remember that.
So at that point, I went from really not understanding or not believing 9/11 to 3 weeks after Madrid when you could say I was pretty much a crazy man. Because it all came to me at once, not only that 9/11 had happened and who had done it, but the realization that the Zionist media was setting us up in real time. They were setting up a story, and they were starting to point it in the direction of Houston. Well, I had media contacts at that point, and we managed to get media contacts of mine to call up FBI National on the 24th of March 2004, and they put the FBI to cover its butt, put the Houston, the Gulf Coast of Texas under FBI warning, alert, terrorist watch. So we actually, our first success, you might say, in running what we now call 911-2B. That means the 911, the nuclear 911 that they keep telling us is going to be. It's
yes.
Not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Yes.
Our first success was in getting a federal alert put up of a 331 attack, which actually happened on 330.
Okay.
Now, what happened at British Petroleum was a minor explosion compared to what we were anticipating, and we couldn't understand that until much later. Now we figured it out. Anytime they decide they're going to do a hit, if you interdict, if you interrupt them by getting information out, they
yeah.
can't do the hit.
Right.
But they can't call it off because if they call it off, then everybody who was in on the criminal activity from the get-go now has no reason not to spill their guts.
Okay.
So they have to go through with some kind of criminal activity to keep everybody on the hook.
I see.
Like a street gang going over five guys and getting the back of a pickup truck to go kill somebody. Well, if they decide at the last minute they can't kill him, they burn his house anyway, so at least everybody's still on the hook and nobody squeals.
I understand.
So that was the first instance, and that's when we went from the simple act of realizing 9/11 to the proactive act of anticipating the 911-2B attack. And I would say that Ghost Troop has become the specialization unit for the 911-2B attack.
Well, I would agree with that. And let me just ask, it was after the Madrid bombings that you finally realized, you internalized, that the U.S. government manipulated or caused or planned or participated in September 11th, and that got you looking to what else they might do, because every time the Bush administration is in trouble, something big happens to try to neutralize the criticism that people are hurling because the Bush administration is not doing something right.
Right. The only member of the Bush administration who ever has been worth a damn has been Laden. They always wield the bin Laden thing out to scare people, but it loses its force. It's like any form of fear. After a while, you become what we know factually and what various members of the police and military community in and around Houston, Texas, and now through a larger and larger percentage of the country and the armed and police forces know, is that not only has Bush been building up the next 9/11 attack, the 9/11 to be, but they have actually made attempts to enact the 9/11 to be attack.
You believe that Houston, Galveston, Texas City area was the logical place for a big attack because that's where a lot of refineries are, that's where a lot of economic activity is, and it made sense that if they were going to do something big, it would happen there because of our vulnerability, because of the economic impact. Is that right?
Well, no, that's the cover story, and those points are true, but they're not the major ones.
Okay.
The major things are that Bush runs this state, and oil runs Bush. Houston is the petrochemical center of the universe. This is the oil place, and Bush is an oil man. Halliburton is 10 miles away from my house here in North Houston, and that's Cheney's kingdom.
How is an attack against the petrochemical area going to benefit oil? Raise the price?
Let's take the British Petroleum Refinery.
Yeah.
British Petroleum Refinery right now is listed as being a $3 billion reclamation project just to get it up to EPA standards.
Okay.
It's the most. It's the armpit of the Gulf Coast. In the same way that you know that the Zionist Larry Silverstein bought the towers 2 months before they came down.
Right.
Doubled the insurance 1 month before they came down.
Okay.
So there's always an economic motive. He made a great amount of money by, you know, and New York City is the Zionist capital, of course. So they set it up, and they made money coming and going. People made money on put options on airlines.
I know that. All right, so you're saying
in the same way, if you do it in the petrochemical area, assuming your people know it's coming, you can blow up a dilapidated facility like BP Texas City, and you can blow up Texas City. And then all you do is you get rid of labor costs that you were paying that are no longer productive. You get rid of a messed up facility, and then you come in and maybe pave it with concrete and put a liquefied natural gas terminal there. You can do what you want.
Because you're starting from scratch.
Right. Well, even better, you're starting from scratch with pre-planning. In other words, what we see as that what they are selling us as a false flag attack, or excuse me, as an Al-Qaeda attack, it is really nothing but a part of a globalist slash Zionist capital improvement project, and they just consider it the demolition phase.
I understand. And the other big benefit, aside from insurance and the freedom to build what they want, the government steps in with taxpayer money to clean it all up, which in the environmental armpit, as you described, is tens of billions of dollars in cleanup costs.
Sure. They pay it off dollars to donuts. Now, they've already written into the EPA code. There's already been revision in the U.S. statutes involving how much radiation people can live around and keep functioning. They have rationalized and prepared the next strike at every possible level to maximize the safety that they have by making it all secret so that it can't be looked into.
Okay.
They've put enough seed corn, enough money in the area to buy up the politicians, the police, and the press. And there's enough profit coming that everybody who's part of it is going to make out like a bandit.
And
it's simple murder. It's just mass murder. Murder's always for profit.
Okay. So when you talk about 9/11-2B, it's not the number 2 and the letter B. It's T-O-B-E.
Well, we get cute. We throw it in with 2B, the number and the letter. But, yeah, everybody's supposed to understand it means the 9/11-2B, the next one.
All right. Now, you successfully forecast an attack down in that area of Texas, you forecasted for March 31st. It actually took place on March 30th. What else have you successfully predicted?
Well, before I say I, remember, I'm the company commander of Ghost Troop. I have 350 people in my unit now.
Okay.
We're a very strong cavalry unit. We're cyber intelligence. We're an internet unit, one of the first, perhaps the prototype.
Okay.
And every time we've been on these missions, there have been different times when I had police officers from the very area. For instance, the March 31st prediction that turned into the March 30th attack, 2004.
Yeah.
Houston Police Department Criminal Intelligence Division, John Carsner, sergeant buddy of mine, was working right along with us. The media, not the high-end corporate media who are in on it, but the local news anchors or editors who didn't have a clue. clue it was coming down, they worked with us.
Okay.
Everybody worked with us but the Houston FBI, which worked against us to shut us down so that the attack could go through.
Huh.
So every time we have had one of these events or one of these interdiction actions, we have always had what we called the police posse, where there were some cops who, against all orders, just on raw instincts and guts, were working alongside of us.
Right.
We've had military intelligence and military people working alongside of us. We've had media cooperating. And it's always been ragtag because it can't be organized, because all these people belong to institutions and organizations that are dedicated to pulling off the operation at the command level.
I understand.
The next time we actually got involved, we predicted the 727-2005 attempt on Houston. Again, we predicted Houston Petrochemical. That was last summer, when you remember that CNN, Fox, everybody was running a special of the week talking about how Al-Qaeda was going to pop a nuke in a port.
Yes.
All summer.
I remember that.
Well, we predicted 727, and on 728, British Petroleum, these guys aren't creative. They pick out a target, and they stick with it, because they've spent years, perhaps decades, preparing the target zone. And the BP went up again one day off, 24 hours, 24 miles.
Hmm.
Same thing happened again. The next one was January 31st, 2006, this year. You'll remember that because that was, do you remember the Mohammed the Bomber cartoon that came out in Europe?
Yes.
That came out February 1st, and it made no sense because all it did was spread bad will across the world.
Right.
And we knew it was a Zionist organized thing, you know, buddies of Wolfowitz, the neocons, the Bush Jews. But the reason it didn't make any sense was because Texas City was supposed to go up January 31st, and that cartoon was supposed to run the next day after Texas City had been bombed and they'd blamed on Al-Qaeda. It was an international Zionist hit, where that was simply the public relations component of it. We predicted 13106 in Texas City. Everybody told us we were crazy. We got no cooperation anywhere, but we got cyber radio like yours, the alternative radio market.
Right.
Well, wouldn't you know, the day after our 131 prediction, a weapons of mass destruction civil support team, of which there are only 10 in the entire U.S. military inventory,
right,
just happened to be on the beaches of Texas City. That military asset that showed up the day after our prediction is called a day after nuclear team. Their only function is to go the day after a city is destroyed and assess the destruction.
So everything was planned then, according to you, for
every time. Now, that time what we did is we got inside of the we got inside the exercise schedule. Some contacts sent us some information saying that they were running exercises out of Charleston, South Carolina, and Fort Monroe, Virginia.
Yes.
Simulating the demolition of a 10-kiloton nuclear device in a U.S. city. Now, they were supposed to be using Charleston, South Carolina as their designated practice area, but we said Texas City. Not even the Texas City newspapers knew that exercise was going to go down. And again, Sergeant Carson, my CID, contacted HPD, Houston Police. He didn't know they were going to be there, and he knows everything about this kind of stuff.
So this team was scheduled to go to that place, and that could only mean that somebody intended to detonate a nuke in Texas City on the 31st.
Right. Unless you want to go with the 1 in 10,000 chance that you just happen to look out your door someday and see a nuclear day after team there, which is what the FBI said. Now, the last occasion that I think bears comment is Chicago. There were Chicago 9/11 exercises where they were going to simulate a Chicago 9/11 attack,
right,
and a building collapse, just like New York City,
right,
on May 2nd through 4th this year. We got word of that April 23rd. I confirmed it through Indiana, Illinois, National Guard Public Affairs Officer, and the Chicago Police Department Public Information Officer on the 26th of April. And then I published an international article. The 27th, Governor Blagojevich comes out with a press statement admitting for the first time, after having covered it up for 6 months, that there were going to indeed be 911 exercises. Now, why did he admit that the day after we caught him? And when the exercises went through, and I'm going to tell you, I don't have fingernails, but I would have bitten them down to the bone because all these were nip and tuck. Guess where Mayor Daley was for the first time in his career, Mr. Turner, on May 3rd, the day that the nuke was supposed to, or rather the day that the building was supposed to collapse.
Where was he?
He was with Israeli Defense Forces and Mossad in Israel, sir.
How convenient.
Right. How treasonous.
Wow.
In other words, sir, straight up, on the basis of my work as an officer on a mission of conscience, I intend to see some people tried for treason, and it could be done successfully on the basis of our work product alone.
In Ohio, how you doing, Hal?
Okay, Brian, how are you?
Good. I sent you an email of a picture of an Abrams tank that was scorched black, and it was half melted. The trench totally gone. That took part in the Battle of Baghdad. It's a picture from Ramzaj Media, looks like a Russian deal here. Apparently, they suddenly stopped reporting right as soon as the Battle of Baghdad ended. And they claim that the Russians knew the U.S. had used a tactical neutron device, and a public accusation from Russians wouldn't be politically expedient for the Russians.
Okay.
It would force them to do something about it. And also, I'd like to talk briefly about the Battle of Fallujah. Now, I was in ROTC for a while, and I've been reading in military tactics for the better part of a decade, and I know a good deal about city fighting. And I don't think there's any way in hell that 6,000 U.S. Marines attacked 3,000 Iraqi insurgents in their own city, their own backyard, lost 35 and killed 1,500. That's not how a city fight happens.
I mean,
look at the Battle of Hue in Vietnam. Look at Stalingrad. Look at Berlin. You get into a city fight, both sides lose 50 to 70% killed or wounded. That's a fact. I believe that Fallujah was horribly covered up. I would say that probably 400 to 500 Americans died at least, and at least 2,000 were horribly wounded.
Sure. It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Unless they used some sort of, you know, tactical device. Which I wouldn't be. I was skeptical of what that officer said, but then I started to, you know, Google all this stuff online, and it's out here, and I had no idea. I didn't even know there were theories about this. I mean, I've always believed 9/11 was a government hit, and it's clear that when Silverstein said pull it, you saw that remark when he said pull it about number 7?
Yes.
I mean, it's clear that a building of that size, you can't have firefighters or demolition people rig it in an hour.
No.
Something like that takes weeks, months. I mean, it has to be carefully planned. It was a perfect implosion. It just caved in on itself. I mean, when I started to believe that sort of thing, I started to say, you know, what else could be out there? I mean, this neutron bomb, I believe it happened. First, I was skeptical, but then I'm seeing pictures of an Abrams tank basically vaporized, melted.
Yeah, that's like impossible.
I mean, the Iraqis couldn't even use their Soviet tanks to knock one out and burn it in the Gulf War I, and where they believe that they could melt one in Gulf War II.
That's absurd.
Okay, so Saddam's been importing something, and it's not, you know, chemical weapons.
Yeah, really.
Some sort of laser ray gun.
All right, Brian.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. All right, you too. Hi, you're on the Hal Turner Show. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Hello, Hal. This is Rick from Ohio.
Hello, Rick in Ohio. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I just wanted to point out, I wanted to remind people the problem people in this country is they don't have a memory. But if you remember back when Bob, what they call him, Baghdad Bob, was on TV.
Yeah.
He was talking about the Battle of Baghdad.
Yeah.
He said that the American forces had penetrated into the airport, but they were immediately counterattacked by Fata Yeen and Iraqi forces, and they were being pushed out as he spoke. Now, this ties in with what he said. There was an ongoing battle there, been going on for hours,
right.
But they were being driven out. They were being destroyed by the Iraqi forces.
Yep.
And then the way the media handled it, of course, they showed film of Humvees parked outside the airport and GIs walking around, and then they just laughed at Bob Dobb, the spokesman, and that's when they gave him the nickname Baghdad Bob.
I remember.
And they just laughed at him and tried to humiliate him, and that was the propaganda on the American people. Because it's easy for them to go in there, get out, take a little footage of the troops walking around before the counterattack comes.
Sure.
So the effect is here, he was telling the truth.
He was.
And all they did, their response to it was laugh at him, ridicule him,